From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Martyrs Without Borders, a talk with Mohammed Hafez, author of Suicide Bombers in Iraq. He says the war has unleashed a new generation of Muslim extremists who care little about national boundaries and are driven by the ideal of defending Muslims whoever and wherever they are. Also, we listen back to an excerpt of our 2004 interview with Tammy Faye Baker, who became Tammy Faye Mesner after remarrying in 1993. The televangelist died Friday at the age of 65. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews two new cable shows with strong female leads played by acclaimed actresses Glenn Close and Holly Hunter. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The number of suicide attacks in the Iraqi insurgency has already surpassed the number of suicide operations by all previous insurgent groups combined, including Hezbollah, Hamas, and Sri Lanka's Tamil Tigers. That's according to the new book, Suicide Bombers in Iraq, The Strategy and Ideology of Martyrdom. My guest is the author, Mohammed M. Hafez. He says the embrace of martyrdom is a sign of our failure in the war on terrorism. We have failed to deprive radical Islamists of fresh recruits, and we failed to undermine the cult of martyrdom. In his book, Hafez analyzes the ideology, theology, and psychology behind suicide attacks in Iraq. He's the author of a previous book about Palestinian suicide bombers. Hafez is a visiting professor of political science at the University of Missouri in Kansas City. Mohammed Hafez, welcome to Fresh Air. How has Iraq set new records in terms of suicide bombing? Give us some statistics.
Well, if we look at the rate of suicide attacks in Iraq beginning in 2003, up, I believe, till April of this year, according to data I have access to, we have about 674 suicide attacks. And I would say that's probably a conservative estimate. There are estimates out there that reach up into the thousands. Prior to 2003, Iraq never experienced a single suicide attack. And so the contrast between pre-invasion phase and after the invasion is really a stark one.
And you say it's mostly foreign jihadists who are the suicide bombers in Iraq. What is the evidence of that?
Well, the data that I've collected, mainly right at this point, we have about 139 names of suicide attackers in Iraq. The predominant nationality of those come from Saudi Arabia, but even if looking at the whole list of the 139 names, we have about 18 Iraqis. That's, I believe, about, I'm not good at math, so I'll let you guys figure that out. But essentially, it seems to be a foreign phenomenon just looking at the numbers of the names that we have seen. But it must be made absolutely clear that the insurgency as a whole is an Iraqi insurgency. So 90%, if not more, of the insurgents in Iraq are Iraqi-born, raised in Iraq, and are fighting an Iraqi struggle. But the suicide bombers appear to have come mainly from outside.
How do you interpret that?
Well, I think the war on terrorism and certainly the war on Iraq have radicalized the new generation of Muslims. What we are doing, whether in the war on terrorism or in the war on Iraq, has not really worked to win the hearts and minds of Muslims. And many people in the Muslim world view our actions in Iraq as a transgression, as a form of aggression, not only against Iraq, but also against Islam. And I think that is the narrative that helps explain why many young people have volunteered to fight and die in Iraq.
So what is the goal of the foreign jihadis who come to Iraq?
This is a complex issue. I mean, there are various types of jihadis that come to Iraq. There are those that are, you could consider nationalists, that have come to Iraq largely prior to the invasion to help the Iraqi army defend against the invaders. I think many of those have either gone back or were killed or just simply, some of them did stay and ended up joining the insurgency and joining the more radical factions. But there are some foreign jihadists that came that were really kicked out of Afghanistan. This is a byproduct of our war in Afghanistan, which I think many of us would accept is a just war. What happened is a lot of the jihadis that were training in Afghanistan, they were forced to look for a new safe haven. Many of them could not go back to their home countries. And so Iraq really fell into their lap. This was a great opportunity to extend their jihadist career, to establish a new safe haven. And it is those people that have really led the newcomers to wage this campaign of suicide attacks against the Iraqi people, the Iraqi security forces, Shiite civilians.
So the jihadis from other countries who have come to Iraq, is there a goal to create a failed state in Iraq so that they have a home for jihadis of other, of different countries the way Afghanistan used to be? Afghanistan was the home of al-Qaeda. It was a training base for militant Islamists from, from around the world.
I think that is the chief strategy behind their campaign of suicide attacks. When we look at the suicide bombings, most of them target, first and foremost, Iraqi security forces and the police, and secondly, Shiite civilians. It is only the third sort of category that attacks the American forces. So what that tells me is the goal is not so much to drive the occupation out, but to collapse the Iraqi regime, deprive the Iraqi state of having sole control over military field, the political field. And these foreign jihadists, because they are interested in establishing a state in Iraq, or a state is perhaps a strong word, even though they have declared a state there, they are seeking to establish a safe haven in Iraq. And they know they cannot do that if there is a thriving central Iraqi state with a strong military, with a strong police, and with a strong security services. So they know that they have to go after the state in order to be able to survive and set up a safe haven, as they had in Afghanistan.
You know, as we're discussing jihadists from other countries who've come to Iraq, one of the well-represented countries is Saudi Arabia, and you say that many of the suicide attackers have been Saudis. Why do you think proportionately so many Saudis are in Iraq and have become suicide bombers there?
I think there are many reasons. One has to do with the simple fact of proximity. Saudi Arabia is close. It's a neighboring country to Iraq. Really, when we look at the other categories, people that have come from Kuwait, Syria, Jordan, there seems to be the proximity tends to attract some of those people. But I think more profoundly, the Saudis have a tradition of participating in foreign jihads. And this is the case since the first or the Afghan struggle against the Soviet Union, the Afghan that was supported not just by the Saudis, but also the Pakistanis and the United States. Saudi Arabia has spawned this culture of promoting the defense of Muslim lands from occupations. So they promoted this in Afghanistan. They certainly promoted it in Bosnia, in Chechnya, and even some have volunteered in distant places like Tajikistan and Kashmir. But it is this culture that has set the stage, I think, for some of these young people to say, well, why in Afghanistan and in Bosnia and Chechnya, but not in Iraq? That contradiction really was something that the Saudi government could not surmount. Also, the fact that Saudi Arabia is really a Wahhabi country, and the Wahhabis with their extreme, I would call it a Sunni supremacist philosophy, if you will. The fact that in Iraq the new government is predominantly Shiite really is problematic for them.
Palestinian suicide bombers, their targets were Israelis. But in Iraq, you have Muslim suicide attackers attacking other Muslims. How do the Muslim suicide attackers justify killing other Muslims in that way?
This is really the most puzzling aspect of my research. In Islam, Muslims, first and foremost, are not supposed to kill themselves. Suicide leads to eternal damnation. Secondly, Muslims are not supposed to kill civilians. And thirdly, Muslims are not supposed to kill fellow Muslims. All three are grave sins that lead one to hell. Yet these suicide bombers, many of them claim to be Islamists, that is, the bearers of the Islamic tradition, indeed engage in all three. They kill themselves, they kill fellow Muslims, and they kill civilians. So what the jihadists have done is look at exceptions in Islamic history to justify the actions of what they're doing today. One exception arose in early Islamic history when invaders used Muslims as human shields. And so people were really struggling with this. What do we do? Is it okay for us Muslims to go kill these Muslims that are serving as human shields in order to get at the invaders? And the answer was, well, if there is no other way to fight the invaders other than to kill these Muslims, and if we don't fight the invaders, the Muslims would ultimately lose, then it is, in these instances, permissible to do that. But the scholars during that time really noted this as an exception to the rule, not the general principle upon which Muslims should fight. But what Al-Qaeda in Iraq has done is really taken that rule and say, well, if we look today, The Americans are in the middle of markets. They are in the middle of our cities. The Shiites as a whole give them political cover. So they have turned this literal sense of a human shield into an allegory or into an analogy, if you will, of the Shiites today shielding the Americans by providing them political cover, legitimacy. And say because they do that, it is certainly permissible to kill Shiites and Shiite civilians. So that's just one example of how they are able to circumvent the sort of clearly established rules in Islam about against killing civilians and killing fellow Muslims.
Are some of the insurgents in Iraq justifying attacking other Iraqis, either in marketplaces or Iraqi security forces, by saying, "Well, they're not really Muslims. They're infidels because, you know, they're collaborating with the Americans."
That's correct, and they use two specific arguments. One, against the Shiites and the Shiite-dominated Iraqi security forces, they say the Shiites are not really Muslims. They are heretics. And what they do is they go back to historical disagreements between Sunnis and Shiites to point out that the Shiites are really a minority in Islam. They're a heretical sect. And therefore, because they are not Muslims, the general rules or the general prohibition of Muslims shouldn't be killing Muslims doesn't apply to them. So that's one way of how they justify these attacks. But I think more importantly, they also use the fact that many Shiites initially, and even I'd say to this point, have not really resisted the American occupation and indeed have benefited from it. And so what they would say is the Shiites are collaborators as a whole, as an entire community or entire nation. They are collaborating with people that invaded our country or invaded a Muslim land. And because they collaborate with infidels, that they themselves then become infidels. And there is a Quranic passage that says those who take the Christians and Jews as their superiors or as their guardians, they are of them, which means that they are no longer Muslim. And again, that's the context in which they are able to justify some of the attacks against Iraqi fellow Muslims.
My guest is Mohammed Hafez, author of the new book, Suicide Bombers in Iraq. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mohammed Hafez, and his latest book is called Suicide Bombers in Iraq. He wrote a previous book about Palestinian suicide bombers. You write about some of the psychological and tactical advantages of suicide attacks. And you describe suicide attacks as basically cheap smart bombs, because the suicide attacker can just target himself or herself at exactly where they want to be. You know, where they want the bomb to go off. What are some of the psychological advantages, do you think, of suicide attacks?
Well, psychologically, it sends a powerful message that what you are confronting, that is, let's say, the U.S. or the Iraqi security forces, what you are confronting are a cadre of people who are not deterred by death. We are so determined to achieve our goal that we are willing to die for it. That is a very powerful message, and it could be demoralizing to U.S. soldiers, to Iraqi security forces, and to civilians. The other message that I think it sends is this deterrence effect. What it tells people who are thinking of joining the Iraqi security forces is you better not, because we have blown up recruitment centers in the past, and we have blown up Iraqi police in the past, and we have killed them, shot them in the head, and things of that sort. It also sends a message to other nations, like we've seen in the Spain attacks, although that wasn't a suicide attack, but the suicide attack would have a similar effect, of telling other nations that if you join the fray in Iraq, you will be next. And that was really, I think, what was intended with the British bombings. You attack there, and you tell the British people that if you weren't in Iraq, you wouldn't be suffering this. And so there is that element of strategic communication that is connected to these suicide bombings.
You mentioned something else that I thought was very interesting, that suicide attacks shame the enemy. What do you mean by that?
Generally speaking, in terrorism, the immediate attention is focused on the victims and the atrocity that has been committed against innocent civilians, particularly women and children. In a suicide attack, this is somewhat reversed. What happens is the immediate attention is focused on the suicide bomber because the act itself is unique or is seen as unprecedented. Although now we have over 1,000 suicide attacks around the world, it is somewhat seen as unprecedented because, you know, after all, who would kill themselves to kill others? I mean, it sounds crazy and it looks odd and morbid. And so rather than focusing on the victims, you end up focusing on the suicide bomber. And invariably, when you focus on the suicide bomber, then people begin to ask, well, what leads people to kill themselves? It must be the oppression of the victims or the countries that represent the victims. It must be the sort of the hopelessness in life that is created by oppressive conditions, by occupations, etc. So the attention is focused away from the victims towards the attacker, and then the attention is then focused towards the country and the conditions of oppression that led people to blow themselves up.
Have you met any would-be suicide attackers?
None that would say that they wanted to engage in suicide attacks. And I think many people that volunteer actually volunteer to go fight, not necessarily to carry out a suicide attack, although I'm sure there are some that volunteer for a suicide attack. But I think generally people go to Iraq because they want to fight. And then while they are there, this option of suicide attack arises. And there are certain dynamics that might produce that. But I did interview a Jordanian who, interestingly, was very secular. I mean, he prayed and adhered to some of the Islamic traditions, but he struck me as more secular than Islamist. He was really into expensive cell phones. He was into the latest video clips that came out of the singing and the dancing and all that. And he wanted to volunteer to fight in Iraq in 2003 before the invasion or before the war ended. That is, you know, it was an entire month and there were a lot of people volunteering. And many governments actually did not stand in their way during that time. But particularly Syria allowed many of the volunteers to go. And so I met him and we talked in 2005. I met one of those people and we were talking and asking what motivated him to do that. And the motivation was not really religious. It was more nationalistic, that we saw the Americans invading a country that had nothing to do with 9/11. I mean, he even doubted that bin Laden was after 9/11, but that's another story. But it was more the nationalism, this sense of arrogance that was taking place. How could one country just without any justification invade another? And he really wanted to register his objection by volunteering.
Do you think that the suicide attackers in Iraq have taken suicide attacks to a new level, have come up with different strategic approaches than their predecessors in other countries?
Definitely. When we look at other conflicts, let's say Hamas against Israel or Hezbollah against Lebanon or the Tamil Tigers against the Sri Lankan government, the goal was always about national liberation or about sort of really driving out foreign forces from a territory that you think is yours. But in Iraq, it's really much more about producing sectarian warfare, and we haven't really seen suicide attacks deployed in that way in the past. So that is certainly an innovation on their part. But also in those other conflicts, the victims were always the other. In the Tamil Tigers, it was the Sri Lankans, the Sri Lankan government, that is. In the case of Hezbollah, it was Israel. In the case of Hamas, it was Israel. Even in the case of Al-Qaeda, the mother organization, bin Laden and his cohorts, the attack was always the West. But in Iraq, it's really fellow Muslims. It's one to create sectarian bloodletting between Sunnis and Shias. And I think that shows the danger of this ideology of martyrdom, that it is so flexible, so malleable, that you could take it and twist it in different ways to apply it in different contexts.
Well, you know, you say that in Iraq you think there's two separate insurgencies. One of the insurgencies just wants to get the United States and coalition forces out of Iraq. What's the second insurgency?
Well, the second insurgency really describes the al-Qaeda strategy of trying to collapse the political system and create a failed state so they could survive. When I talk to Iraqis, they make that distinction.
So that they'll have a home, so that they'll have a failed state to make their home.
Correct, absolutely. In the way that they had a home in Sudan at one point, in the way that they had a home in Afghanistan at one point, where you have either a failed or a weak state that is dependent on outsiders, or that it cannot prevent outsiders from setting shop in their territory. But when I interview Iraqis, they make that distinction. They make a distinction between what they call the honorable resistance on the one hand and the indiscriminate violence. And the Iraqis are the ones that often blame the al-Qaeda folks for the indiscriminate violence. So that distinction really comes from them and not from me.
Mohammed Hafez is the author of Suicide Bombers in Iraq. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Classics edition of The Federalist, papers by Hamilton, Madison, and Jay, in stores and online at bn.com. And from TIAA CREF, helping those who serve others plan for and live in retirement, online at tiaacref.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Mohammed Hafez on the difference between al-Qaeda in Iraq and bin Laden's al-Qaeda. Also, we listen back to our 2004 interview with Tammy Faye Baker, who became Tammy Faye Mesner after remarrying. She died Friday. And David Bianculli reviews two new cable shows. One stars Holly Hunter, the other Glenn Close. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Mohammed Hafez, author of the new book, Suicide Bombers in Iraq, The Strategy and Ideology of Martyrdom. He's also a visiting professor of political science at the University of Missouri in Kansas City. The group al-Qaeda in Iraq is behind many of the suicide bombings in Iraq. I asked Hafez if al-Qaeda in Iraq was connected to bin Laden's al-Qaeda back when al-Qaeda in Iraq was created.
Most experts that follow this closely would say that Abu Mus'ab al-Zarqawi, who started the al-Qaeda in Iraq, initially was in Afghanistan, and he may have even had connections or contacts with people like bin Laden and Zawahiri and some of the men around them. But generally Zarqawi had a different strategy from bin Laden, and that led him to create his own training camp separate from the al-Qaeda camps. So bin Laden had a camp, al-Farouk camp, and some others, and Zarqawi had a camp called in Herat, Afghanistan. I think it's called the Tawheed wal Jihad camp, or sometimes it's called Jundisham camp. There are disagreements on what the actual camp was called. But essentially, they were two separate groups. Bin Laden was focused on the far enemy, attacking the United States and Western and its Western allies. And Zarqawi was really interested in attacking Jordan and Israel, what we call the near enemy. After 2003, when essentially the far enemy became the near enemy, when the United States invaded Iraq, that distinction really no longer made sense, and many of the jihadists then began to work against the United States. And that set the stage for the use of the title al-Qaeda in Iraq. Let me just add one more fact, and I hope I'm not confusing the audience, but initially when Zarqawi went to Iraq, he did not set up a group called al-Qaeda in Iraq. He set up a group called Tawheed wal Jihad, which again shows that he was separate from al-Qaeda.
So really the invasion of Iraq united jihadi groups against the United States.
Yes, not just the invasion of Iraq. I think the whole war on terrorism did that. Prior to 9/11, the jihadist movement, if we could speak of it as one unit, and I think we can never really do that, but let's just for the moment speak of it as one unit. The jihadi movement was split between those who wanted to fight the United States and those who said, no, the priority should be getting rid of, say, the Egyptian government, the Syrian government, the Jordanian government, and what have you. After 9/11, when the United States sort of launched this war on terrorism that essentially fought a war against all radical Islamic movements, the distinction between the far enemy and near enemy no longer made sense, because a lot of, let's say, the Algerian jihadists began to see the United States give money and military support and political support for the Algerian regime to repress the radical Islamists, even though Algerians, generally speaking, never attacked the United States. Same thing you see with the Philippines, with Indonesia and others. I mean, it's just, generally speaking, all Islamist movements saw that the United States was fighting a war against them, even though initially they did not want to fight the U.S. And I think that's one of the failures of the war on terrorism, is our inability to distinguish between those who are radical but don't want to kill us versus those who are radical and do want to kill us.
Can I ask what country your family is originally from, and if that has helped you in your research to understand anything that you've been researching?
Sure. I was born in Kuwait, but I'm actually of Palestinian parentage, so I never really lived in Palestine. And for a long time, I had a Jordanian passport before I became a U.S. citizen. So if that is not entirely confusing to you, I don't know what would be. But essentially, I am of Palestinian heritage, but really, I've lived in America most of my life. But because I come from that part of the world, I often can engage, sort of present myself as sort of this spokesman of the Arab and Muslim cause in America. So I often, when I interview people, I say, the American public does not know why people are volunteering to Iraq, or the American public does not know why people are dying, killing themselves in order to kill others. And when I present it in that way, it is not threatening, it is not interrogating, but it's merely saying that I want to be the channel through which you could convey your motivations to the American public. And I found that to be really a very effective research strategy.
And I guess there's a lot of truth to that. You do want to understand what motivates them.
Absolutely. And I don't presume to know what motivates them before I interview them. Yes, and I think I bring also a kind of a cultural sensitivity that may not be easily developed in new researchers. Don't get me wrong, I don't want to claim that only Arabs can research that part of the world. But there are many American, native-born Americans and Europeans that study that part of the world and understand it very well. But I think for newcomers, there's a kind of a nuance that is often missed, and a kind of understanding the suffering and the historical sense of humiliation that many Muslims feel, but is really not palatable to newcomers to that area. And it's that sense of humiliation, I think, that underpins this culture of martyrdom that has really come about since the early 1980s and developed in the 90s, and now we're seeing come to full fruition in the new millennium.
We only have a minute or two left, so I'm going to ask you a really, really big question and ask you for a really short answer. So let's see how we do. You know, Americans and Congress are debating what to do in Iraq. Now that we're there, how do we get out? Do we get out as quickly as possible, or do we need to keep a presence there to prevent Iraq from falling apart even further? If we stay, we remain just the kind of target that they're looking for, you know, that the insurgents are looking for. But if we pull out, do we stand a greater chance of leaving a failed state behind us, just the kind of place that the Al-Qaeda and other radical Islamists are looking for?
I think in Iraq, the commitment there, what is required to make Iraq into a viable state, forget a successful, thriving state, but a viable state, it is going to require a tremendous commitment in terms of troops, resources, money, and ultimately sacrifice in terms of sacrificing American lives. If the American public is willing to make that commitment over the next 7 to 10 years to try to get Iraq right, because up to now we have got it completely wrong, if we are willing to make that long-term commitment, I do think it is worth it. But we also have to know that it is going to require tremendous sacrifice, not just in terms of money, resources, and costs, but also in terms of American lives. I think it is worth it. But if we are not willing to make that commitment, if we are only looking for quick, you know, till September or another year or 2 years, I think that then it is, the only option is for us to substantially reduce our forces and to seek new strategies. Because this is not a job that's going to be 1 or 2 years or even 5 years. It is going to be a long-term struggle. And if we're not willing to make that long-term commitment, then might as well begin reducing forces now. Let's not waste any more American lives. But the consequence of that is the jihadists will indeed declare their victory, and they have reason to do that. And it does mean that Iraq will slip deeper into a civil war, perhaps even a genocidal civil war. And it does mean that the region will be destabilized, because Iraq will be the arena for a proxy war between various factions in the region. And so it's not an easy thing to say that we need to stay, but it's also equally problematic to just simply leave.
Well, Mohammed Hafez, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Mohammed Hafez is the author of Suicide Bombers in Iraq. Coming up, we listen back to a 2004 interview with Tammy Faye Baker, who became Tammy Faye Mesner after remarrying. She died Friday of colon cancer. This is Fresh Air. Tammy Faye Baker was considered the first lady of televangelism in the 1980s. She died Friday of colon cancer at the age of 65. We're going to listen to an interview I recorded with her in 2004. Tammy Faye and her first husband, Jim Baker, helped build Pat Robertson's Christian Broadcasting Network and the Trinity Broadcasting Network. The Bakers' own empire included the PTL, Praise the Lord, network, their televangelist variety show, the PTL Club, and Heritage USA, the world's first Christian theme park. Their empire fell apart in 1987 after Jim Baker was in the headlines for committing adultery. He was later convicted of financial fraud. In 1993, Tammy Faye changed her last name to Mesner after marrying Roe Mesner, who built Heritage USA. Over the years, she became something of a gay icon, as paradoxical as that may seem. The week before I spoke with her, she hosted a drag bingo AIDS benefit. Here's an excerpt of our 2004 interview. In your book, you say that Jim Baker used to watch the Johnny Carson show and felt that Christians needed their own talk show. Why?
Well, because we needed to be able to talk about God, just like Johnny Carson talked about the things of the world. And so he asked Pat Robertson if the children's show became something that was going somewhere and really helping, if we could one day do a Johnny Carson type show. And after we had done the children's show for about 2 years, Pat finally let Jim do the first 700 Club. That's what they named it.
It's almost like talking about God the way Johnny Carson talks about celebrities, because that's what he really talked about with celebrities.
Well, who is the greatest celebrity?
Well,
God or... It was wonderful. We talked about God as a, you know, as a real person, not as God up in the sky or God somewhere else around. He was God that was right there with us, and that's what we Christians believe, that He is right there with us, part of our lives every day, and that's what we that was what our talk show was about. And we talked with other people. We have Christian celebrities too that we, of course, bought into the picture.
How did you start raising money on the air?
Well, we had to raise money. You know, we didn't have Coca-Cola. We didn't have all the commercials that all the other stations had, that the secular stations had. So we had to figure out a way to buy airtime, pay employees, and do all those things that a regular television station has to do. And so the only way to do that was to raise money.
But you ended up making a lot of money and having several really beautiful homes.
Now, how do you know that?
Reading,
Miss Terry.
Reading about you.
Yeah, you read, but you probably heard about it in the rag magazines. But our home that they said was such a mansion was not a mansion. It was an old house that we bought and redid. We had a small home in Palm Springs because it was the only place that we could go to get away. And we, at one time, had a small home in Gatlinburg, which was just a little cabin. And so those were our homes.
But really, I mean, you did have what I think everybody agrees was a pretty opulent lifestyle.
We had a very nice lifestyle. We did. But it was given to us by our board of directors. And we didn't, you know, we didn't ask for it.
Well, I guess the larger question is, were you comfortable living in that kind of opulent lifestyle, knowing that a lot of the money was coming from listeners who probably weren't living anywhere as close?
Terry, we worked so much that I never thought about it. Mm-hmm. Our whole life, my husband, Jim Baker, worked almost 24 hours a day. And he worked so much, and I worked so much, that we just never thought of it. The thing about money is this, in my estimation, when you have money, you never think of it. When you don't have money, it's about all you think about. And we had enough to where we didn't have to worry about money. But we never thought about the fact that we were getting paid too much or too little or too whatever. We never thought about money. And that's God's honest truth.
Some of the televangelists have preached quite loudly against certain, quote, sinners, and have suggested that they should be very marginalized in our society, particularly here the way some of the televangelists, like Jerry Falwell, for instance, have preached against homosexuality. You, on the other hand, have actually become very close to a lot of gay people and are something of a cult figure among certain
gay people. Well, they were
people.
Well, I think I did a show back when I was doing Tammy's house party, and I did a show not even knowing it was going to ever turn into anything special, Terry. I did a show with a gay man who had AIDS, and my heart went out to him because I felt like people were treated, that no one would hug him, no one would even get near people that had AIDS at that time. And they were so looked down upon, and I felt that was wrong, to be looked down upon for a disease and be blamed for a disease. And I felt Jesus would have gone to that person and put his arm around them and loved them and cared for them. And so that's why I did that show, and that show turned out to be something that I never dreamed in the world would change my life someday.
I'm wondering if you've met gay men who do you in their drag show. You know, if
oh,
they
yes.
Do, they
many
do,
of
yeah?
them.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yes. And they do me better than me. I love it. I think it's so fun.
Since you obviously have friends who are gay and you have something of a gay following, what's your reaction when televangelists preach that you know, gays are doomed to sin, that we should protect our youth from gay people, that gay people should be marginalized, they shouldn't be allowed to marry, they shouldn't be allowed to teach?
I think that preachers should be allowed to preach the word of God. I don't think they ought to pick on certain people or certain sins. But the gay people and I love the gay community, we have agreed to disagree. I am not a homosexual, and the gay people know that I don't believe in the homosexual lifestyle. But we have agreed to disagree on that and go ahead and love each other and care about each other anyway.
Now, there was a documentary made about you a couple of years ago.
Yes, the Eyes of Tammy Faye.
Right, and it was made by Randy Barbato and Fenton Bailey, who also made the movie Party Monster. What impact did that movie have on your life? It was a very sympathetic portrait of you.
Well, to me, it wasn't as sympathetic as it was truthful. They delved in and got the truth of the situation as it happened. See, I didn't even, when they asked me to do this, I said, no, I will not go back. You cannot go forward looking in the rearview mirror, and I can't go back. It hurts too bad. I finally got my life on, you know, back on track, and I'm not going back. But they convinced me to go back with them. And I traveled with them for almost 2 years. Doing things, they followed me and the things I was doing, and they talked to the people that had been part of my life, and they got down and got to the bare, where the rubber meets the road, and they did not. They said, "You are not going to be able to see this till everybody else sees it. You are not going to be able to know what's in it. You are not going to have any power over anything that we tape or do. Are you willing to do that?" And something within me, and I have to think it must have been God, said it was okay to do it. And so I trusted Randy and Fenton, and thank God that I did, because it changed my life.
How did it change it?
It changed my life by people seeing me as a real person other than a cartoon figure that I had been pictured as by so much of the media.
Talk a little bit more about the cartoon figure.
You know, I had always been pictured as a little fluffy little bubble head with big long eyelashes and big jewelry that didn't have a brain in her head. People realized that I'm a relatively intelligent person. I'm a person with deep feelings. I'm a mother. I'm a grandmother. And that I've done a lot in life. And I have had a lot of life's experiences. And that's what they were able to show through the eyes of Tammy Faye.
Tammy Faye Messner, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. It's been a pleasure.
Tammy Faye Messner, formerly Tammy Faye Baker, died Friday of colon cancer at the age of 65. Our interview was recorded in 2004. Coming up, David Bianculli reviews two new cable shows. One stars Glenn Close, the other Holly Hunter. This is Fresh Air. It's a good TV season for strong, complicated women, at least on cable. The season premiere of Kira Sedgwick's The Closer on TNT last month attracted more viewers than any scripted show in that network's history. Tonight, after an episode of The Closer, TNT unveils another drama with a strong female lead, Saving Grace, starring Holly Hunter as a troubled detective. And tomorrow night, another cable network, FX, presents Glenn Close in a new drama series, playing a powerful and ruthless attorney. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
It's becoming more and more of an open secret that for women, especially those too mature for the cover of Maxim magazine, some of the best and most challenging roles in Hollywood these days are to be found on TV. And as the broadcast networks waste more of their time and money, especially during the summer, on mindless reality shows, cable TV is the new place to be. Glenn Close stuck her toe in the water last year, joining the FX drama The Shield for one season as the latest boss of rogue cop Vic Mackey. She was wonderful, and clearly had a wonderful time, for now she's signed up as a series lead. So has Holly Hunter, whose TV roots go as far back as the 1989 telemovie Roe vs. Wade. In Saving Grace, Hunter plays Grace, an Oklahoma City detective whose life is a mess. Series creator Nancy Miller counts on Hunter's likability to keep us involved and sympathetic, even as the opening episode quickly piles on one vice after another. Grace smokes. She drinks. She burps. She has aggressive, passionate, unemotional sex with a married man. Oh, and a little later on, she drives drunk, runs into a pedestrian, and kills him. Even for a cable drama out to shock, that last one is going too far. It turns out it is too far. It's a dream, or a vision, or a warning. Something that comes to Grace, she discovers, courtesy of a divine intermediary. That's where Leon Rippey, a familiar face from Deadwood, comes in. He plays Earl, a smirking, mocking, tobacco-chewing angel. Yes, Saving Grace is another of those guidance from beyond dramas. It's a lot better than Touched by an Angel, and close to, though not yet as good as, Joan of Arcadia. God visited Joan personally in that series, in the guise of many different people. In Saving Grace, God sends Earl, who speaks to Grace, but doesn't always give her a straight answer.
If there's a God, tell him to bring it on. I got some questions for him.
Let me guess. You want to know why there's evil, betrayal, tragedy, and death?
Basically, yeah.
Well, it doesn't work that way.
Well, then tell me how it works. Angels, heaven, God, death, whole deal. Explain it to me. Heaven first.
Well, the whole pearly gates thing's more like an opening in the clouds with this gospel choir of angels singing you into glory. No throne. God sits on a monster Harley. Whenever you hear it thunder, he's starting that baby up.
Well, you, Earl.
Well, wait, look, I'm sorry. It's just you guys always ask the same questions. I'll give you the answers. There's no room for faith.
You have to have faith to hope Saving Grace is leading somewhere worthwhile. It's interesting that Grace brings physical evidence of the angel to a forensic scientist, played by Laura San Giacomo. But so far, it's not at all credible what she or Grace does with that information. Over on damages, there's a lot less required in the area of suspension of disbelief. Glenn Close plays Patty Hughes, a lawyer who's so tough and devious and maybe even unscrupulous. She's like a female J.R. Ewing with a law degree. When you're opposing her in court or negotiating for a settlement, she's as formidable as they come. And even when you're on her side, working with her, she's just as hard-edged and just as cold. A young, talented actress named Rose Byrne co-stars as Ellen, a hotshot new lawyer who is recruited by Patty, kind of the way Tom Cruise was hired and steamrollered in the movie The Firm. At first, it appears that Patty may look upon Ellen with a kind of maternal instinct, until Patty reveals, with typical iciness, her true feelings about being a mom.
Do yourself a favor, Ellen. Don't have kids. I read an interview once with a Nobel Prize winner, a physicist, genius, married 6 times. He said, don't have kids. Ruins your ambition, keeps you from what you want in life. He said to have wives instead. You can leave wives. You can't leave your own kids.
Thanks. I'll keep that in mind.
My son came out of me perfectly healthy. 10 fingers, 10 toes. Everything works. I've managed to keep him alive for 17 years, but I am not a good mother.
I'm sure you are.
Kids are like clients. They want all of you, all the time.
Both the acting and the writing on Damages managed to be delightfully surprising. The leading ladies are excellent, and the show starts off with a host of strong recurring players. These include Tate Donovan as Patty's right-hand man, and Ted Danson as one of her wealthy, arrogant courtroom targets. Glenn Close and Ted Danson worked together on a fabulous TV movie, Something About Amelia, 23 years ago. A generation later, they're teaming up again, and once again, going where the best work is. This summer, it's cable. The creators of Damages, Todd and Glenn Kessler and Daniel Zellman, surprised me several times in the series pilot. They took the plot and the characters places I wasn't expecting them to go. I'm very grateful for that. Being surprised by a scripted TV drama these days is a rare treat, so Damages qualifies as one too. Meanwhile, over on the broadcast networks, even finding a scripted TV drama is a rarity. Basically, I've taken the summer off from broadcast TV, because basically, broadcast TV has done the same thing.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. We're podcasting now. You can download our show by going to our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. From the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And from hotels.com, with virtual tours, customer reviews, and over 70,000 properties to choose from, online or at 800-3-HOTELS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
But if even I can find someone, there's hope for us all. Whoa.
On the next Fresh Air, Nick Lowe performs songs from his new CD, At My Age. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
For us all. But if even I can find someone, there's hope for us all. Whoa.
On the next Fresh Air, Nick Lowe performs songs from his new CD, At My Age. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
For us all.